Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the June episode of City Talks. Today, my guest is Tony Travers from the London School of Economics, and we're going to be talking about the general election, the results and what it means for cities, the urban policy agenda, the new metro mayors and local government more generally. So, Tony, were you as surprised by the result as I was?
I was indeed as surprised as you were. I had been predicting a moderate Conservative majority, having looked at the change of the polls. But in the end, not for the first time in Britain in the last 3 years, indeed for the third time in the last 3 years, the electorate, and this is an important issue which will affect local politics, has shown itself willing to vote not just in an unexpected way, but I think in the referendum last year and these elections this year, to some extent to use its vote to express a view that has much less to do with conventional left-right party politics and rather more to do with things that we feel the conventional political system isn't delivering. And, you know, a broader sense of our, in some people's rage against the machine and for other people just wanting to get things that normal political parties can't, or their political party can't deliver. So I do think these results tell us something more than the actual, you know, vote to leave the EU, vote for a hung parliament.
And certainly a resurgence of two-party politics, but also a real muddying of, you know, the no longer the Conservatives regarded as being the party of the rich and Labour party of the poor, indeed not even Labour being a party of the Midlands and the North and the Tories being of the South and the Shires. All of that has been mixed up, which makes it a bit more challenging to kind of pick our way through it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think your point is well made. I mean, it is true that the Conservative plus Labour vote at, what, nearly 84%, is the biggest since, I think, 1970, and certainly for many years.
Yeah.
But what I think most of the evidence suggests is that that's not simply a return to, you know, 40-ish percent of people voting Labour, 40-ish plus a bit, in this case, voting Conservative, settle back into nice tribal units. What I think this is at least a section of the electorate, we don't know how much, willing to use these two block parties in a two-block party system.
Yeah.
But voters being willing to use these parties for the thing they want of it today, which is a different thing to, you know, people being mostly Conservative or mostly Labour, because my mum was or my dad was or something like that, which tended to be how people voted in the past, or this is how people like me are. I think people are now using the two block parties, so the Conservative and Labour big parties, just as a way of expressing a view about something. So clearly, to make the numbers make any sense, there are people who probably didn't like Jeremy Corbyn, who are Conservative voters, who voted Labour in London to send a message about Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's quite a long way from, you know, voting just out of normal party loyalty.
Mm.
And I suspect there will be some the other way. There'll be people who are Labour voters in northern, smaller cities who voted Conservative because they want to deliver Brexit and so on. And
yeah.
It's not only about Brexit, by the way.
No, quite. And we were, I wrote several blogs before the election suggesting that we may well see the Conservatives take some of the urban marginals, which we didn't really, well, we saw a little bit of that, but not as much as we anticipated.
Yes, we see a bit of it in the East Midlands and West Midlands and the Yorkshire and the North East, but much less than was expected. Mm. And what happened by common consent is that the Labour vote, which had gone to UKIP, in part came back to the Labour Party. Enough of it went to the Conservatives in some northern areas to help the Conservatives to win. But over the country as a whole, the rise in the Labour vote, which was actually, 10 percentage points, was substantially bigger than the rise in the Conservative vote, which was nearer, 6-7 percentage points. And that explains the result. And that the implication of that is that the UKIP vote, which collapsed, split much nearer 50-50 between the Conservatives and Labour. And the Green vote, particularly in cities and towns in the south of England, just dropped into, they saw Jeremy Corbyn as the best chance they'd had for years.
Yeah. So
the Green vote fell as well.
So do you think there's a... What's your sense that... I remember after the the American elections of last year, there's a sense that amongst many things, clear urban-rural divisions between voting intentions and outlooks on life. And we've seen a bit of that, I think, in the general election, but maybe not for the reasons you've just described, not as clear. But, what's your sense as to geography? How do you think about the geography question in relation to voting intentions, given all of these factors and rationales and reasons are swirling around?
Well, it's clear that a number of the core cities which voted Remain have remained true to Labour, in a sense that they have probably seen the Remain vote reinforce the Labour vote in a number of core cities. So the inner areas of most cities have remained or have continued to be Labour held. A bit more willingness on the outer parts of English cities to move towards the Conservatives, particularly where there was a strong Leave vote. But of course, the standout place, I'm afraid, on this occasion, is London,
yep.
Which shifted significantly to Labour and away from the Conservatives. And I used to resist the idea of describing London as a Labour city. You can't see it in any other way now. I mean, Labour got 55% of the vote in London. And they got 40% nationally, so 15% excess, as it were, in London. And the Conservatives, if you look forward, we've got London Borough and Met District elections coming up next year. The Conservatives are going to get, again, on these figures, will do badly in a number of London boroughs. And the Conservatives will pull some seats back in the Met Districts and the outer parts of other big cities. But the Labour-held central parts, generally, of the other cities, I think Labour will reinforce their votes there too. So there is a sort of core city and London versus outer city and sort of suburban split in Russia.
And why? What's your sense as to why those patterns have become more pronounced? Is it sorting by the population, in the sense we know that people like to be near people like themselves, and we have quite a strong sorting in this country through the housing system, through education system? Is that just part of it, or is there something else around? We've been in, does living in a city alter your view on the world? I mean, that's an interest, as opposed to cities are the place where people of a certain outlook on the world come to, they go to live there.
Let's give a classic answer to this. It's probably
a bit of both,
isn't it? But the one thing we mustn't fail to discuss this time is there appears to be evidence of a surge in registration among younger voters.
Yeah.
And although we don't have detailed numbers yet, some evidence of a surge in voting amongst younger voters. And again, we don't have much evidence of this, so I'll be cautious. Probably some of that is going to be associated with a response partly to a reaction against Brexit, possibly also some intergenerational political stuff. I mean, as one Corbyn-friendly commentator in the media, when faced with the question, wasn't the Labour Party's manifesto commitment to get rid of student fees simply effectively a bribe to the young? And we responded, well, what about the triple lock on pensions then? What's that?
Yep.
I mean, there's a kind of... So there may be some intergenerational stuff as well as it playing out. I mean, the intergenerational debate has been going for some time now, and I think probably that's got tangled up along with Brexit in this. And of course, because of the large number of colleges and universities in cities, it would be surprising if this hadn't helped Labour.
Yeah, I think that's right. Interestingly, I think the tuition fees seem to have a larger galvanising effect on the young than, say, Help to Buy or Help to Start housing policies, which were equally naked policy interventions by the previous Chancellor, George Osborne.
So it would appear. And of course, it would be unusual not to mention in an analysis of the general election across the board that the Conservatives' epic policy mistake of the what came to be known as the dementia tax was equally and oppositely a big negative for the Conservatives, whereas the student fees policy was clearly a positive for Labour, and indeed more than that, just the general suggestion of an end of austerity for Labour. This does have an implication looking forward for sub-national government. And I think that, in a sense, that, to use that word that we can't use in this way so much anymore, created momentum for the Tory vote to sink and the Labour vote to rise, and that momentum carried on through to voting day and to polling day. And lessons will be learnt by the Conservatives, but they'll be learnt by the government now, the minority Conservative government, and I think that will mean that they're going to find it hard not to lighten up on austerity a bit, and that does have implications for cities.
Yeah, well, let's turn to to the implications for urban policy agenda and cities and local government and mayors. I mean, I think it's fair to say the appetite and the enthusiasm of the May government, as short as it was, for the city's agenda, for urban policy agenda, wasn't as strong as, was enthusiastic for, as the Osborne and Cameron coalition government, before Brexit. So I think there's a fair point, there's a bit of waning, and similarly, I think, the Miliband leadership of the Labour Party had much more in favour of this agenda than maybe since Corbyn's taken over. So I think you get reflection on that. But where then does the result and the implications of it, how does that leave us in terms of the urban policy agenda, thinking about our cities as the hubs of creativity, innovation, growth, etc.?
I mean, interestingly, the ill-fated Conservative manifesto did include an explicit commitment to allow urban areas to continue to create combined authorities with directly elected mayors, but an equally explicit rule that rural areas wouldn't be required to do this.
Yeah.
And so that, now, difficulty is that that manifesto, in effect, doesn't stand because we're going to have a minority government with DUP support, and the Queen's speech is going to be some sort of lightly based on that manifesto, but with quite a lot stripped out, I guess, version of what the Conservatives would have done with the large majority Theresa May thought she was trying to get. So if we sort of look at where does this leave city policy? Well, interestingly, given that there's been a bit of discussion in the last few hours, really, for hours and days, about whether there might have to be a bit more cross-party linkage and of working on Brexit. Mm. Interestingly, I mean, cities policy and mayors and combined authorities, Labour and the Conservatives couldn't really put a bus ticket between their policy. I don't think Labour are going to oppose more mayors if it came down to it. Now, I'm not saying there's going to be a grand coalition or anything, but it's not a particularly controversial thing if, parts of, north of the Tyne or south of the Tyne or the Leeds city region or, other medium-sized cities went for a sort of city regional approach. You can see that might still get the go-ahead. All, of course, now hinges on what the returned Community Secretary Sajid Javid and his ministers decide are their priorities. They've got the law extant. They can create more city regional mayors without law. But I think the bigger issue is how far the government will go ahead with things like business rate retention.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, probably. No reason to think they won't. And indeed, in fact, you'd expect if Brexit's going to dominate Parliament and there won't be much time for legislation other than that, and by the way, the House of Lords is now liberated to give the government a half time, as indeed is the House of Commons, yeah. Parliament is the big winner out of the election, then actually carrying on with, or sort of keep calm and carry on policy inside DCLG would make perfect sense. Mm. I mean, the policy, it's all there, it can all be done. So you might expect a sort of steady state policy in DCLG. We'll find out, obviously, in the weeks ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, do you think, I mean, what's your thought on, you know, we've got, obviously, there's a focus sometimes on whether the manifesto stated for new mayors and, you know, extra mayors, as it were, and Conservatives certainly said that. I'm maybe not as favourably, you know, in terms of the way that the Labour manifesto...
I don't think Labour was actually obstructive, was it? I don't think there was anything in the manifesto saying they're going ahead with it.
No, they wouldn't. I don't think they said anything about the fact that they would take them away.
Mm.
So, but if I remember right, I don't think there was any mention of them one way or another, which, you know,
yeah.
Then there is plenty of scope for, you know, for debate and discussion on that. But so in relation to so there's a focus on the extra... But what are your thoughts on, obviously we've got six, if you include Sadiq Khan as that, we've got seven Metro mayors now. Four of them are Conservatives, the biggest Conservative mayor being Andy Street. What are your thoughts on how the government might or will preference them, you know, give regard to them on matters to do with the industrial strategy, for example? Or the infrastructure investment decisions that come from the National Infrastructure Commission, Andrew Donis's outfit, or, you know, the Productivity Fund or Local Growth Fund. You know, I think there's a genuine question about whether those mayors, or certainly some of those mayors, get preferential treatment within a national system for a local government, you know, Local Growth Fund or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to observe with the directly elected mayors, is that they will be now sort of relatively within the British political system slightly more powerful in relation to national government than before, partly yeah. because national government has weakened itself. It didn't intend to weaken itself, but it has.
Mm.
So the legitimacy conferred on the recently elected, directly elected mayors, with actually what turned out to be a reasonable turnout, rather higher than most people had feared at the lower end of their expectations.
Yep.
And, you know, if we just pause for a moment to look at the visibility given to Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester and Sadiq Khan in London after the terrorist attacks in Manchester and London, there's no question that these figures are now seen as the civic embodiment of the wider city.
Mm.
And I think that, in a sense, that's a reality. And beyond that, with the government now much more dependent on than in the past on Parliament and on the kindness of strangers, frankly, that city mayors, city regional mayors, have the chance here to drive bargains with the government probably rather more easily than in the past.
Mm.
And by the way, if Northern Ireland is to be given all manner of infrastructure investments, do you think that's not going to have a wash back into the Northern powerhouse? If I were a mayor or a city leader in the Northern powerhouse, watching Northern Ireland being coated in bridges and, you know, with connectors and whatever else they'll want, assuming that all goes ahead, what a powerful reason for MPs in the North, Labour and Conservative, remember the Conservative new MPs will want to cement in their position there, they'll be able to say, well, nothing to do with Brexit, but we do think we deserve a bit more investment too, actually.
Yeah.
And the same will be true of the Midlands cities as well.
Yeah.
And indeed London. So the weakness that the government has wished upon itself, however accidentally, I think will empower mayors and the MPs in the same areas who've now got enormous power to drive harder bargains with a government that has very little choice now, but to accede to any group of MPs who turn up to it what they want.
Yeah.
Not easy.
No. So following on that theme, how do the mayors need to, you know, to behave in order to take advantage both of their increased mandate, their increased power and significance, obviously, and the weaknesses of the government? You talked a little bit about, you know, it seems to me that getting themselves into an oppositional perspective or mode of working with the national government is not really going to be productive. So they themselves are going to have to, you know, reach out, make coalitions that span their geography, span their boundaries, and also span probably their political parties as well. But, you know, what's your advice to them? What would you be thinking? You know, what should they be doing?
I mean, coming back to something you asked me about earlier, to which I didn't respond, it seems to me the positive thing they can do is to say, well, we accept Brexit's going to happen, but here is our vision, our picture of what this city region and its hinterlands economy will look like in the world after we've left the European Union. Because that gives creates a sort of piece of a national jigsaw. I mean, a jigsaw, by the way, which we don't actually know anything about, because the government, not quite the original consultation document on the industrial strategy was a bit broad brush. So, if I were the mayor of the Liverpool or Greater Manchester or West Midlands city or, you know, West of England city region, I would be saying, look, this is what we need out of Brexit as a minimum. You need to do this, this and this within the bounds of reason. And then actually it'll be easier now to demand a bit of a place at the table, because the privileged position that Northern Ireland will get, and actually Scotland is going to get because of the power of the Scottish Conservative MPs, means that England yet again risks being left behind. And I would expect not only the city regional mayors to be making this case, but frankly the county council leaders. Well, they're a powerful group. They have lots of Conservative MPs that they can ask matters of. So that's how I think I go about it, primarily through the industrial strategy, but also, you know, reacting to the generosity shown to Northern Ireland, if it is, and Scotland, if it were to be, by saying, well, what about England then? What about the Northern Powerhouse? What about the Midlands Engine?
And I think that, I mean, I completely agree with that. And do you think, you know, as you see them going about their, you know, their in their early days, are you, you know, convinced that the mayors themselves, you know, not so much the individuals, although there's clearly an element of that, but the position, the institution itself, can they do that? I mean, you know, are you confident they can do that, they can achieve that?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the new city regional mayors outside London, there are many interesting things, is they start life, I mean, they are starting life, and it's worth remembering back to 2000, when the Greater London Authority was set up. It did take 2 months, you know, to get everything, you know, into place before the mayor could formally take over everything. And so the first 2 months, and we're still in the first 2 months, well inside the first 2 months, we're always going to be a time for people and for mayors to kind of get their bearings, appoint staff. Now, the new city regional mayors have fewer opportunities than the mayor of London to appoint, you know, big sets of staff, but the combined authority in each case would, in my personal view, be wise to give the mayor the wherewithal in terms of official support. Some of it will have to be new and will require a little bit of money to be spent on it, so that the mayor's office is powerful enough to deliver these kind of messages and commission the kind of reports and so on that they need. And, you know, personally, I think that the mayor's office and its capacity to control the bodies that run services for transport and police in Greater Manchester's case and so on. The core of government has to be strong enough to be able to have all the intelligence gathering functions that a government needs and just enough power to deliver strategies and service control, you know, from that core. And it's got to be more than the mayor. The mayor's got to have an office powerful enough to do that.
Mm. And on the flip side, Tony, what are your thoughts on how do you see, you know, the situation, empowered, emboldened mayors, hung parliament, weakened and, you know, political division, I suppose, between the two main parties? How does that affect, you know, Whitehall? So, you know, the the non-elected bit of government, in the sense of how the Whitehall departments will view this. I mean, obviously, Brexit was already a significant issue, is going to stretch their capacity probably beyond their ability to respond, in my opinion. And now, obviously, they've got hung parliament, which, you know, further adds a set of considerations and issues into what they do and what they don't do. I mean, what are your thoughts on, you know, on that? What will that do to Whitehall?
Well, I mean, Whitehall, you know, let's look at it from Whitehall's point of view for a moment. On the positive side, from Whitehall's point of view, I think they too are empowered by this in the way that Parliament and both Commons and Lords are, actually, because the government is even more dependent than before on the skills, intelligence, flexibility and capacity to write that the civil service is famously and rightly prized for. So that capacity to brief ministers, to provide them with the, you know, remember, they're going to have to get tickets to Brussels and then hoof it back to Westminster to vote all the time, these ministers now, in a minority government. So, you know, the rail ticket buying capacities of the civil service will be important as well.
So a hyperloop between Brussels
exactly.
and Westminster could suddenly be a national infrastructure priority.
Indeed, I think I'd look for that one first, actually. So I think the civil service gains power out of this.
Yep.
And by the way, you know, they must have had to start working very rapidly on a more detailed run-through of what Labour's policy was in the middle of the general election campaign, having not been so instructed in advance of Brexit last year. And my guess is they'll be keeping a beady eye on the minor possibility that the government fails and that somehow a Labour minority government takes office for a while.
Yep.
So all of that has to be borne in mind, in addition to Brexit.
Yeah.
Now, Brexit, we can't know whether the government is completely tooled up for Brexit with a, you know, brilliantly thought through negotiating strategy backed up by all the paperwork it needs. I guess it'll have quite a lot of paperwork and briefing notes, less certain about the strategy and the position. So, and I think what the government was hoping was that it would have a large majority and then it would be able to go into the negotiations empowered with the majority and then, as it were, deal with all of this as it went along. Now, that won't be possible. And by the way, Brussels is likely to leak most of everything that happens, so they'll be dealing with that back home. It's going to be very difficult for ministers. So I think from the civil services point of view, this result empowers them, and it certainly empowers the top of the civil service, the permanent government, significantly. On the negative side for the civil service, you know, there is a risk that this doesn't look very well done.
Yep.
And although ministers got the civil service into this mess, civil servants and their capacity to run the machinery of government and to sustain effective policy, financial, domestic, and Brexit, and international policy, you know, that if there's any sense that the government is not really fully functioning, some of that would wash back into the permanent government, into the civil service as well. So on balance, I think the situation we're in is probably good for civil service power and authority, but there are risks.
But we also, so on that, which, you know, fascinating, but I mean, you know, I know, there are pockets of the civil service of Whitehall that are not in favour of our agenda. The devolution, urban, you know, stuff being done in different ways, in different places, by different sets of actors and institutions and partnerships. If they're emboldened and empowered, should we, you know, what should we be worried by that?
Well, I mean, they'll be emboldened and empowered in relation to ministerial power.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the whole of government, including elected ministers, the cabinet and the civil service, are much empowered by what happened at the general election.
Yeah.
And so sub-national government, and by that I do embrace, you know, the DUP and Northern Ireland, the Conservatives in Scotland, and Wales, actually. I mean, all these, so all of the nations within the UK, other than England, but within England, the directly elected mayors and the bigger and powerful counties, you know, they are relatively empowered by all of this. Now, question, you know, will the local government association and the representative bodies of all the groupings, you know, within local government feel that now is the time to strike, to make a case with Whitehall for, as it were, effectively to say, look, Brexit is going to be an all-consuming, frankly, endless night-after-night business for you in the next few years. We can run domestic policy.
Yeah.
Kind of a split up. This is the split that existed in the UK, you know, up to the First World War, really. Yeah. You know, Parliament was interested in the empire and the dominions, and local government ran everything else. Now, we're not going to go back to that, but there's an element of that could come out of this, because it's hard to exaggerate the body blow that the central government has taken on the basis of two elections held one year after another, where the sophisticated people at the top of the system got it so badly wrong.
Yeah.
So it isn't just the two prime ministers. It goes beyond that into a sort of systemic concern. And, you know, there are people outside the UK, we don't see this so much, asking questions that boil down to, is Britain less governable than it used to be?
Yeah.
Well, that's not a great position to be in.
No, very true, very true. Let's turn up towards the to local government in general. And you've been writing this week in relation to some of the statements now about the austerity agenda is over, and whether that's true and whether it's not. I have my doubts on some of those sorts of things, but rightly people commenting on that said, don't worry about what people say, follow the money, and you know that will give you a sense as to whether austerity is over. You're not convinced that local government, if austerity is over, would be a winner or even a, you know, would be on a level playing field with other interests. Just say a little bit more about that.
Well, let's start with the DUP's relationship with the Conservative Party, Democratic Unionists. I mean, they didn't want an end to the triple lock on pensions or state pensions. They wanted to keep the winter fuel allowance. Yeah. They have other interests, not least of which are more money for Northern Ireland, which, I mean, more money for Northern Ireland in the great scheme of things is not actually that much for the UK, for the Treasury. But the keeping the triple lock certainly is as a commitment.
Yeah.
And beyond that, I think the fact that if you talk to Conservative MPs, and I have done to one or two since the weekend, without exception, they say austerity is an issue. One MP I spoke to said to me, you know, if you talk to people, they say, look, we signed up for 5 years of this to reduce the deficit, just about managed that. We're now into the eighth year of the 5 years, with several more to go beyond the tenth.
Yeah.
And that's not what we signed up for.
Yeah.
So, having said that, your scepticism is reasonable because the cupboard is bare.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is that Philip Hammond, you know, who is, in a sense, a serious, stable overseer of the nation's finances, for, you know, for whom I think all of us need to bear in mind that that pivotal position is an important one, and his capacity only to say what he wants to say and not getting involved in all sorts of sort of flim-flam is an important characteristic. But he's got to make the books balance, and you know the credit ratings agencies are kind of worried about whether Britain now needs to be downgraded. If we get downgraded, there's a risk that the cost of our debt will go up. We've got a lot of debt, cost of servicing the debt. So but on the other hand, I think the Conservatives risk being painted into a corner as they limp on in government, which is that whenever the next election comes, the more people see that their streets are not particularly clean, or that adult social care doesn't get better fast enough, or anything else that they see locally, will be seen as a sort of physical representation of austerity having gone on too long. And I think that, you know, it's a really, really awkward problem for the government. This has been a problem that's been brewing for some time. How to, as I say endlessly, how to provide a public sector the size of France or Sweden's with a tax base the size, or the tax level the size of America's. But now people have seen the Labour manifesto, and it was apparently was popular, offering more money for this, that and the other. And the Conservatives now have to think of the next election. If Labour does that again, and the Tories are offering another 5 years of austerity.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one because, I mean, that would suggest, well, let me suggest several things, but tax rises will have to come into the, you know, to be a bigger part of the consideration if just simply cutting public service expenditure is less acceptable. And, you know, interestingly, I haven't followed it closely, maybe you have, you know, government enabled local authorities to raise 2 pence on the council tax. Mm. The vast majority of them did that. I didn't get a sense that there was a backlash against those authorities that did that, in part because I think, you know, people realised that it was being used for something very specific, hypothecation, which we know national government doesn't particularly like, but local authorities could use it. So, you know, there's a kind of there's an interest in there where some of that austerity management could fall at the door of local authorities, and they could well be better placed to do that.
Yes, I mean, they could argue to have the freedom to put up the council tax rather more even than the extra amounts they've been allowed to by the government to pay for adult social care. But in the end, I think it needs a bit more than that. That's the difficulty. You know, after local authorities, and particularly city authorities, there are city authorities, many of the inner and core cities, who've seen their budgets cut by 35 to 40% over 7 years. There is no way that that is going to be replaced. I mean, when we're discussing an end to austerity, we're effectively saying it might stop at 40% in some cases. Yeah. Well, you know, give me a break. Yeah. And that's not exactly a return to the sunlit uplands of pre-2008 or pre-2010.
No.
So, you know, these are minimal differences. But I do think, actually, for most cities and much of local government, if a government said, we're not going to cut you anymore, we guarantee your funding where it is today, which, by the way, would make business rate retention a much easier policy to introduce.
Indeed.
And if you backed up that with no school is going to lose out of the redistribution of schools funding, I think local government would think that was actually a win. Actually, it doesn't cost the Treasury that much money.
No.
Little bit of money for the losing schools. And actually, local government not losing much more money than it's got today, I mean, it's not getting back to the 35 or 40% that's been cut, but it would be a predictable future, which I think many councils could work with.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where I think I'd expect to see it go, rather than money being, you know, tipped out of helicopters over Manchester and Liverpool.
Yeah, and we need to, we'll bring that close quickly, but I want to get your thought on, because we talked a little bit about the amount of cash that, or the amount of money that local government may or may not get. Where it gets it from is obviously part of the live, you know, as a live conversation. We know, you know, the business rates bill got so far and obviously fell before the election. I think at the minute, at least, there's an intention to bring it back, maybe in some modified form. But that in itself brings some challenges for how you deal with this. But I mean, what's your insight on, what's your perspective on that?
Well, I have no insight yet, and I guess the government doesn't yet, because the crucial thing for DCLG is, will, you know, the limited amount of parliamentary time that is not consumed by Brexit. You know, what are the bills that... Now, actually, for a minority government, which won't want anything controversial, I mean, there'll be fewer foxes there'll be fewer controversial things and more pretty straightforward stuff. So actually, in that sense, legislation to empower the devolution of business rates, you know, doesn't sound very controversial to me. So might get through, actually. It's the kind of thing that the Queen's speech could include, whereas some of the more controversial stuff about foxes and grammar schools, possibly not.
Mm. No, I think that's right. I think it's the how contentious it may ultimately be. And I think, you know, how much local authorities and the local government sector is a willing player in that, in the sense that they're advocating for that change and therefore make it easier for some of the national politicians to make those decisions, because they know they're not going against the will of, you know, their local councillors, local places.
Yeah, I mean, that raises a very interesting further question, doesn't it? Because I do think with the coming of city regional mayors, who will be, and already are, actually powerful national figures, and we were in a position where, you know, the city regional mayors are going to be better known national politicians than most ministers of state.
Yep.
Okay. Now, against that backdrop, I think for local government as a whole, and perhaps particularly for the Local Government Association, you know, they're going to have to think long and hard about they manage a brood of local authorities and the lobbying needs of the whole of local government against the backdrop of city regional mayors, any one of whom will be better known than anybody at the Local Government Association.
Yeah.
So there's an implication for how local government collectively lobbies in future and how they use the power of not just actually the city regional mayors, but I keep coming back to them, the sort of powerful leaders of the big counties, particularly in the south, who are very powerful people who have always been willing to operate alongside their MPs to get things, you know, for their area or for the county interest.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think with the counties wanting to see themselves as different and as powerful as the city regions' new players, for local government as a whole, how it lobbies on this stuff corporately is going to change.
Yeah, excellent. My guest today has been Tony Travers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.